Welcome to Most Holy Family Monastery's radio program for this Friday night. We'll be having a special guest shortly that will come on. Just wanted to mention a few of the conversations we've gotten into with some of the people that we've been speaking to over the phone. Just actually speaking to a lady from the Philadelphia area who got one of our DVDs. And she actually was going to a Novus Ordo church and called up about 9 different Novus Ordo parishes. And 8 of the 9, the priest at the parish told them that the story of Adam and Eve is a myth. It's just not true. So she finally found one out of her area that actually, where the priest said, no, it's not a myth, and was going there. And now has gotten our information and is willing to accept it, but it's just, I guess, even surprising sometimes. You know that things are pretty bad, but sometimes you don't realize how bad it can get. I was also talking to another guy, actually, who actually reviewed all of our material, or a lot of our videos, and he actually said he would be willing to go to a Protestant church in his area if that was the only thing he had. And it's a pretty bad situation. Got another letter today from a lady who actually likes our material and is actually, quote, married to a priest who's ordained back in around 1958. And she's actually criticizing her, quote, husband because he was a priest and she was criticizing him because he was laicized under Paul VI, which is a totally novel kind of thing. There's no such thing as this in the Catholic Church where a priest can go back into the world and get married, obviously. And she's actually not even validly married to this guy, and it's just, and doesn't even realize it, but yet seems to be familiar with some of our stuff. So we really need to keep praying the 15-decade rosary each day to make sure that we don't get wrapped up into this diabolical fog that people are in for the most part.
And obviously there are many examples of many people who are coming to the knowledge of the truth and waking up and responding to the traditional Catholic faith. But what he wanted to just simply comment on is that it's quite a common characteristic to encounter people who are just mired in this spiritual cloud, where even when they, for instance, claim to agree with the DVD that we have, for instance, on the new Mass, which demonstrates that it's not valid, they still go to it week after week. I mean, this is not an isolated case, but you talk to so many people like this who they just don't get the point, or they don't act upon the information, not because they don't understand it, but because they're not putting out the level of effort that they should be putting out. And so it really is, the only way we can really think of describing it is that it's a spiritual fog that so many people are under, and that's why it's critical to really pray so that we all have the grace to see what's going on.
And maybe right before we bring Patrick in from the Northeast, maybe you can just quickly mention a new thing that came in today on Benedict XVI going to maybe possibly completely abolish limbo or attempt to do that.
Yeah, we mentioned this on a radio program a few months back that there were discussions among members of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith of the Vatican II sect that they were going to publish a document saying that limbo is not Catholic teaching and that all unbaptized infants, therefore, are considered saved. And apparently, numerous news reports, we were sent numerous emails about this, and we'll have more on it when it's officially published, have confirmed that he has approved this and that it's been officially published today. So this is quite a development, considering that it's a solemnly defined dogma that all who die without baptism, and specifically mentions children and infants who die without baptism, are not saved. And maybe I should just read some of those passages.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is you read some of these news articles that are written on this topic, and they act as if this has never been settled. They say things like, you know, the church has never actually defined what happens to these children who die without baptism, but it had leaned this way. I mean, just pure ignorance of the traditional teaching of the church and pure nonsense. Of course, this is mentioned back at the Council of Carthage, where Pope St. Zosimus, you can find it in Denzinger, he anathematizes anyone who says that there's a place in heaven for children who have died without baptism, and he cites John 3:5. But I want to read the Council of Florence from Session 11, February 4th, 1442. This is ex cathedra. Regarding children, indeed, because of danger of death, which can often take place, when no help can be brought to them by another remedy, other than through the sacrament of baptism, through which they are snatched away from the dominion of the devil and adopted among the sons of God. So there's no other remedy to go from the dominion or domination of the devil to become a son of God, which is necessary to be saved, other than the sacrament of baptism. And this was also actually, interestingly, confirmed by a proposition which was condemned at the Council of Constance. And this was a proposition made by John Wycliffe, who was a heretic. He said, "Those who claim that the children of the faithful dying without sacramental baptism will not be saved are stupid and presumptuous in saying this." So in other words, this heretic is saying that it's stupid to say that the children of the faithful who die without water baptism will not be saved. Basically saying what the Vatican just published is true. And that was anathematized in the strongest terms by the Council of Constance, and actually in one of the sessions which was approved eventually by Pope Martin V, because certain sessions of the Council of Constance were not approved. And maybe I should read some of the words that were said about these propositions. Here's what was said about these teachings of John Wycliffe, including the one I just read. "This holy synod, therefore, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, repudiates and condemns, by this perpetual decree, the aforesaid articles, and each of them in particular. And it forbids each and every Catholic henceforth, under pain of anathema, to preach, teach, or hold the said articles or any one of them." So it's anathema. One would be anathematized to embrace the same position, which is rampant today, of course, in the Vatican II sect. And then one other thing I'll just quote is from the Council of Trent, Session 5 on Original Sin. You can find this in Denzinger. "If anyone says that recently born babies should not be baptized, even if they have been born to baptize parents, or says that they are indeed baptized for the remission of sins, but incur no trace of the original sin of Adam, needing to be cleansed by the laver of rebirth for them to obtain eternal life, let him be anathema." So if anyone says that they don't have original sin, which must be cleansed in the waters of baptism for them to be saved, let him be anathema. So my question is, with this document now published, and the Vatican II sect and Benedict XVI publicly taking the position that essentially all unbaptized infants go to heaven, even if you accept the ridiculous arguments in favor of baptism of desire, or you hold that position in baptism of blood, even someone who would hold that position would have to admit that it is a dogma that, generally speaking, infants cannot be saved without baptism, and that this new position of Benedict XVI and the Vatican II sect, no matter what kind of certain exceptions you want to include, which obviously this admits of no exceptions, but even if we give them that, they would still have to admit that this is just an utterly heretical rejection of any understanding of this dogma at all. So it's just another major heresy coming out of the Vatican II sect and coming from anti-Pope Benedict XVI, and it makes it all the more clear how ridiculous it is for people to continue to recognize this guy as a Catholic and as a legitimate pope, especially when they've seen, you know, all the evidence.
So we're going to bring on Patrick now, and we'll start with maybe the first question to Patrick.
Yeah, we were going to talk about his experiences. He's a traditional Catholic, and his experiences as a former adherent of the positions of the Society of St. Pius X. Perhaps, Patrick, you could start by giving a description of your position when you were going to the Society of St. Pius X before you had come across any of the information proving the Sede Vacantis position. What was your general position on the new church and the new mass and those issues?
First, thanks for having me on your show.
Sure.
And thanks for all the information you've given me over these years.
Sure.
I guess when I first came to the SSPX, I was I guess you'd call me a pro-lifer, Novus Ordo person, going to, not daily, but trying to go to the daily Novus Ordo Mass. So it was and I was doing a lot of apologetics with Protestants about the Catholic Church, but I had really no clue of apologetics and what it really was, but I knew there was something missing. So when I came to the SSPX, of course, I was enamored by the Mass. I had never seen it. And of course, I held that John Paul II was the Pope, and that was very important to defend that position. And right about the same time, I had received your first issue of Voice Crying in the Wilderness, which I guess it just was, it kind of scared me. I thought, you know, what is all this stuff? So I went down there to that Latin Mass chapel, the SSPX chapel, and it was refreshing to meet a lot of people who were dressed very modestly and very reverent and practicing devotions and, you know, very much into the rosary and the holy name. So I felt like I had found all the answers. But then, as I was reading that first issue, I was asking a lot of questions, and everyone was giving me and directing me to the bookstore and a lot of the writings of Archbishop Lefebvre, and that British writer who wrote extensively on the Mass. Yes, his name escapes me. But so I was given a steady diet of the SSPX basic positions. But whenever I would try and proffer the arguments from your material, I was always directed to the priest there who had apparently told all the other parishioners, you know, take that material and throw it in the trash can. He just didn't want to discuss it.
Prior to receiving our material,
yes.
Had you come to the conclusion that there were serious doctrinal problems with John Paul II or the new Mass?
No, actually, I was really bad off, I guess. I had read, I had struggled through many of John Paul II's encyclicals, and I was, you know, crossing the threshold of hope. I had read Redemptor Hominis, and I don't even think I knew what they said, but they were very, you know, flowing, and I was very much a proponent of John Paul II. And I guess I was just—I didn't know why people weren't standing up for things and why you couldn't just go to the church for answers.
How long had you been going to the SSPX chapel before you had come across our material?
I got them at about roughly the same time.
Huh.
But I was basically kind of reading it and keeping it to myself, and I just thought it was extremist stuff, you know, some group that went off on some tangent, like, you know, like there are so many other, that's how I felt about the material when I first got it, and so I started going to St. Jude's, and people kind of steered me away from your stuff, and steered me into the Lefebvre's writings, and the SSPX priests who have, you know, published books on baptism, and the general state of the church and things like that. So for about a half a year there at the SSPX chapels, I was, you know, in agreement with them. They were affirming that John Paul II was the Pope, but they were pointing out many of his scandals and sermons and things like that. So I thought, wow, this is a good thing. And started to really question what was going on in Rome and things like that. But something didn't make sense, because here, all that I had been arguing with the Protestants while I was a Novus Ordo person on the primacy of Peter was now being directly denied by the SSP. Although they'd affirm it, yet they'd deny it.
When you started to get into the specifics of some of these issues with some of the people you knew there at the chapel, did you find them receptive to the idea of discussing these issues, or mostly non-receptive.
They were receptive in sort of a way like, we know how that feels, but you'll come around, go talk to Father on this. They know all the answers to this stuff, and you'll come to know that there are this conditional circumstances where it's okay to resist the Pope and do our own thing and not acknowledge the Pope's authority because of a lot of canon law, legalistic arguments and things like that. And I kind of got dizzied and lost and convinced by them until I picked up, I think at that time you were coming out with your second issue and your third, where it really started to take on SSPX positions and really buttress them with doctrinal pronouncements and things.
Uh-huh.
And that's when I started to really challenge them. And then if I challenged them with authority and saying, hey, you're wrong, this is the magisterium of the church, that's really when the trouble for me there began. If I spoke with authority,
uh-huh,
and didn't speak kind of as one of the lost souls that wandered in through the doors that they kind of pick up and it kind of runs the engine there.
So generally speaking, you would find some people who would want to engage you on the specifics, or most of the time they would just refer you to the priest?
Well, there were some of them who were more well-read, kind of hobbyists, I'd call them,
mm-hmm,
theological hobbyists, and people that liked engaging in debate. But they kind of, if there were people that were receptive to my arguments or to the arguments that I was learning, they weren't my arguments, they were the arguments of the church, specifically on papal authority, it was more of a quiet conversation at a little table off in the corner that basically knew the lines were drawn. And that's when I started seeing not two camps, but the people that would attend kind of the holdout, receive the sacrament group, and then what I call like the nucleus group that's, the community, the families that are pulling activities together, leading processions, organizing homeschool activities, trips to the ordinations in Winona, like that group. That was very much the, what I call the real social group of the chapel, just didn't want to engage in discussion because they just felt like it caused fights. They had seen fights in the past, apparently, and they just wanted to avoid confrontation and have a nice community.
Yeah, so the emphasis on preserving the community rather than engaging in any
issues. Yeah, and that was the, I guess it always ate away at me as because... At the time, I was struggling to raise two children in the Catholic faith that I had found. And I think any families out there who have, young ones like 2, 4 through 10, you kind of really see them being influenced by the company they keep. So if you start finding the truth of the doctrine of the church and the importance of the faith, you're hurting for your kids, wishing they had somewhere to go. So you're kind of longing for that community, as a lot of families that are traditionalist are really seeking to fill that missing piece. And so there are a lot of families there that, because of that's kind of being fulfilled there, with a chapel and Sunday mass and kind of a throwback to maybe... I guess it gives me the sense of like the 50s or 40s when my parents, the way they talked about things. And so any types of arguments on doctrine, they seem to really want to steer away from because it would cause division. And I think they put, you can't single anyone out. I'm speaking in generalizations,
Do you recall any specific points or specific arguments that you brought up which caused you to really realize that they were running from the truth on these issues? Or
where I came to a head, of course they directed me to the priest, which I didn't shy away from. I think I saw through the tenure of four different priests during my stay there, and I always ended up with each one getting into the matter of salvation, baptism as a necessary act for salvation, water baptism, and also the primacy of the chair of Peter, and the immediate and absolute jurisdiction and authority of the Pope.
You recall numerous instances in which people revealed that they definitely believed that people could be saved in non-Catholic religions. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I would have talks with it was actually shocking to me when I really got into it with some people whom I had really held to be well-read individuals. They would quote a lot of saints, a lot of doctors of the church, and obviously, you know, just without, you know, referencing or notes, they're very well-read on, I guess, you know, SSPX and that type of literature. So they would really defend baptism of desire, and you know, and they had a number of priests, especially ones, you know, teaching out of the seminary, who had authored books, you know, and quoting their writings and their arguments, you know.
And when
they
you
were really hot on that point.
And when you got into the specifics of that issue, you would see that they would reveal that they believed that Jews and Buddhists and Muslims, is that correct?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. You know, when pressed to the point, you say, well, then, you know, you do then hold the possibility that, you know, a Jew or a Muslim or a Hindu or a, you know, a pagan could be saved, and then it was, yeah, of course.
So you would say that was the dominant response of those you talked with?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I know you mentioned, I recall one time in a conversation we had, a young person there who was considered sort of like a model example of a Society of St. Pius X youth, and you had gotten into the specifics of some of these issues, and I found it interesting what you had said about how she said something like, you know, we know Jews can be saved, or do you recall that at all?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's a great family, if you will, like a lot of kids. I mean, it was one of the girls within the family, very well spoken, you know, catechized and all that, and when I had, I would engage the younger people, because I guess partly because I homeschooled my own kids, and I thought it was important for the, you know, the young people to be, you know, conversant and talk about their faith, and it was, you know, so I would, more than most, I was involved with the homeschool, you know, so I was around these kids a lot, sometimes, you know, leading the activity, so it was very common for me to engage them in discussion, and one of the young comparatively to me, you know, just finished high school, where I was heading out to one of the SSPX high schools at one of their remote locations, and she overheard me discussing with, I guess, debating on the matter of the Jews having rejected the covenant, and she overheard me saying that, and she was kind of like, I guess like a lot of people there were, they would, when you start, like I did, talking openly and really, you know, engaging people, even though you know they didn't really want to hear it, you know, they start to get attitudes about you, and I think the parents share them with their kids, and then one of their kids sort of spoke up and said, you know, that's completely ridiculous, you know, Jews can be saved under, you know, certain conditions if they're of goodwill, etc., and I engaged in her, it like a, she was going off to school, and so I, you know, had a little email exchange to her, and I kind of cut and pasted a lot of the quotes of the fathers on the state of the Jews, and she just basically wrote it back and word for word denied the I guess the syllabus, the 15, 16, 17 syllabus of errors, where the indifferentism is expressly condemned. Her wording was, the syllabus items in the reverse, practically. I don't have the letter in front of me, but
wow.
Yeah, that's what they were learning, and that's what they were teaching. And in order for a young person like that to come back at me like that, they had to be instructed in that way. You know, it's unusual for a young person to really come out and take a strong position, although it's not impossible.
So,
but this is what they were teaching at their schools, in my opinion.
So this was an example of someone who would be considered a model member of their...
Absolutely.
Chapel, and she is outspoken in favor of the idea that Jews can be saved. So
absolutely.
Totally devoid of real belief that you have to accept Christ. And that's,
right. And
I think that reveals quite a bit about the lack of faith present among the people going.
Oh, yeah. And very, you know, and very supported by, you know, the priest that she's under the instruction of at the schools, at least at that time. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, may well be taking on, you know, assistant teacher positions in the schools that are there, you know, at this point, because this is now, I guess, you know, 3 years gone by. So a lot of the young people that are active in the society, they go on to these, you know, schools to work and, you know, either join their seminaries or go on and join the schools. The SSPX has several schools that they're, you know, building up, you know, in the Northeast area, and these and the more prominent people go on and, you know, fill in teaching positions and, you know, like, leadership roles in those schools. So, I mean, I was convinced. I don't know if others are convinced. I was convinced that that's, you know, that's what they're learning.
Didn't you mention also, I think one time, like, they had a function for a priest that came over, is held at someone's house, and they basically, people are in bathing suits and swimming. I mean, it's as far as the general liberalism we're trying to find out. About what was do you remember that you were telling us?
It kind of varied from place to place, and you know I also, you know, and until a certain point was a participant in that. You know, it varied kind of from house to house. You'd have some people that, you know, if they would have a function at their house, would although I think they were the minority, you know, would insist on, you know, traditional. conduct. But yeah, I mean, there were, you know, swim parties at some of them.
With the priest present?
At the one I was at, I just can't recall for certain. But, I mean, at most of these parties, the priest was always invited, you know. I just can't say
so,
on this one.
So he was probably aware of, you know, what may have been going on there or what they had set up for him to come to.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. So
yeah.
So with your encounters with people such as this young girl, you started, I think you mentioned to us in one of our conversations in the past, that you started to really realize that the appearances were quite deceiving in so many cases, that these people who appeared to be so dedicated to the faith at Sunday Mass and appeared to, you know, have a strong devotion to God, actually, when it came down to it, had almost zero devotion to God's truth, and it was really a bunch of externals without any true substance.
Well, in the final analysis, I mean, that was my ultimate conclusion, you know, and I acted upon it, because, I mean, the externals are very powerful. They were for me. But when you really, you know, contemplate these things in, you know, in the quiet of your mind, and you're really, really trying to find the truth, you know, certain things don't work. Like I think the one, like near the end when I finally left, was I think it was José María Escrivá was canonized, quote unquote, by John Paul II, and the and the priest at the time was, you know, very much actively telling everyone, you know, that this doesn't have to be followed, and, you know, we have our extreme doubts. And that was kind of being echoed, as I understood it, from the other chapels in the SSPX, and it was coming from above. I mean, that was the message they were sending down. And I think at the time you had posted an article, it was The Difficult Dilemma, or one of those articles which just said, you know, here's a perfect case where you can't really have it both ways, And I really felt that the priest was, you know, teaching heresy. And as far as he was basically denying the authority of Peter in the certain language that was used by John Paul II, if he were to have been Pope, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so I told him, you know, Father, this is, you know, what you're teaching is heretical. You know, you're teaching my children, you're teaching all these people. And so he kind of patronized me. And he's like, well, then if it's heresy, you must report me, right? Like in a kind of a joking, condescending tone.
To people who believe the same thing.
Excuse me?
Yeah, who are you going to report him to? His Peter Scott?
Right. I mean, I was like, well, you know, I don't want to. I felt uncomfortable even then, in getting into a disrespectful speaking to, you know, a priest, an ordained priest, and I was like, well, Father, if you really mean that, I mean, do you really mean that? Like, I really wanted him to know, and he's like, well, of course. And then he, like, shifted tone. If that's what you believe, then, you know, you should, you know, put that in writing and make it known. And I'm like, all right, you know, I will do that. But it was kind of like my final act there, you know. And so I kind of, you know, put together a letter and sent it to him as requested and said, you know, could you hand this to your superior as you requested, you know. It was kind of a strange situation, but I guess I was struggling in my heart every day at, you know, in the chapel as I would go to confession and put myself under, you know, the priest himself and feel like not only did I have an obligation to others to correct them, at least to inform them of the heresies, but even to the priest as well. But it was at that point, I guess, after that interaction with the priest that I just said, you know, that I was, I guess, attributing to them too much, believing them to be more goodwill than they were. That was kind of like the last straw for me. But I had also written several letters to the then district superior, Father Scott, on baptism. You know, like 7 back and forth email exchanges where I was directed to him by the priest, you know. It's like you go to the priest, he's like, why don't you take this up with Father Scott, which I did, you know. I guess I'm just following their rules, you know. And he was kind of receptive in the beginning, but when I began to quote the quotes that you had from the books, there were 2 SSPX books on desire, like an orange covered and a blue one about is Fenianism correct?
It's Catholic, yeah.
And I just re-quoted some of those arguments, and then they said, at one point he asked me, you know, are you somehow related with the diamonds? And I said, well, you know, frankly, Father, what does that have to do with anything? I'm not quoting the diamonds, I'm quoting the church here. And he said, because if you are, you know, you must be like them. And then he just went to ad hominem arguments, and I gave up with him too. But it kind of all came to a head there, and I just realized that, you know, the efforts that at one time I really was making in good faith were just apparently fruitless, and I kind of just stopped trying. And also the priest at one point, you know, when I wrote the formal letter to him, said that if I continued to teach my children in this manner, I would, you know, he would have to withhold the sacraments from me and them. And so I said, well, okay, I don't want to.
And what priest was that?
That was Father Gonzalez.
So he held that to hold the position that you need to be baptized is heretical, in his opinion.
No, the specific point we were arguing at the time was that I told him that you can't teach that someone is a pope and then teach that he's to be ignored when he uses infallible language, binding language in a canonization.
Yeah.
And he said, if you continue to, you know, hold that and teach, that was the specific point that he said that to me on. But
if you held that position
on the
canonization? If I held it and made it known to others in that manner, like if I was persistent in, because at the time, I think to put it in perspective, I'm not only speaking to him, I'm speaking to all these homeschool moms and some dads, you know, and also talking with their children when their children, you know, not going and seeking out children, but, you know, some of the older ones, a little more curious, would listen in, and, you know, and I would engage them. And I think they're going to Father and being like, you know, Father, this Pat, you know, he's just, you know, it's our children now, you know.
So that priest wasn't fazed at all by the solemn language that John Paul II used, which you made him aware of.
No, he was just, you know, I guess caught up in the whole the disobedience thing that they do. I don't know what to call it, but...
Yeah, I know some people that hold the same kind of position as the Society of Pius X said that the Escriva, quote, canonization would never happen, that God will not allow it to happen, because they realize the implications of if it did happen, you know, that it's not something that that a valid pope could promulgate, or maybe they were thinking that that could be a possibility. And then, of course, it did happen, and they just... kept their position.
Yeah, so they have to change their position, I guess, to keep on going.
Yeah, and I wonder what they're going to do when John Paul II is, quote, canonized.
The same thing, I would think. You know.
I had a question. If I recall correctly, you had some problems with one of your family members, like your mother. Maybe she was espousing certain things that were heretical. And essentially, I wanted you to speak to this issue. That, if I recall correctly, many of the members or some of the members of the Society of St. Pius X actually took the side of your mother in her advocation of Novus Ordo positions or heretical positions. Is that correct?
Well, I can't recall exactly. I mean, it's the truth that I, you know, I would have ongoing, you know, arguments with my mother, arguments of the faith, I should say, you know, were centered around, because she was, you know, attending the chapel and, you know, being befriended by all these nice people, and, you know, I was prevailing upon her, you know, number one on the issue of the Pope and also on to the salvation dogma that, you know, you just can't do this. If you don't, you are heretical. And then I was, you know, apparently, you know, like any mom would be, you know, stressed out and hurt by a son, you know, saying something like this. To share that with, you know, people that were willing to give her consolation there. And then after that, I had people, you know, come up to me and say, now, how could you say such a thing to your own mother, you know, and kind of pressure me like that.
Yeah.
And at one point, I just said, I don't, you know... It matters not whether someone's my mother or my brother or my father. It's on these matters, it doesn't make a difference.
Maybe, Patrick, we're going to actually, maybe we'll go to a call. Yeah, someone had a question. He grew up in the Saudi Pius X, Peter from Brooklyn, New York.
Yeah. Yes, hello.
Go ahead, Peter.
Yes, hi. How you doing, brother?
Hi.
I grew up with in the society. I was listening to this guy as far as the comments he was made talking to Father Gonzalez. I just wanted to make a comment that something I knew. I have a very large family, and one of the things, my comment is, that the society does, and it's very obvious even by what he's telling you. And I also have Father Pfeiffer over here as a guest in my house to speak to him about similar things as this gentleman has. They just strictly want you to rely on them, their intellect, as far as being able to decipher what is happening in this world today, they take the position that Archbishop Lefebvre, who is, you know, who has taken on the resistance pretty much almost singularly by himself, enables them to be the voice of what has to be, you know, what is true and what isn't true, and they are the only ones who can decide this. And it's very obvious by almost most of the parishioners that go there that they just put their, you know, everything into them. If they can't argue with you about anything, if they don't know how to respond to something you say, they'd be like, oh, just talk to Father. Very typical of what they would do. I've been in arguments with my sister constantly, and I just try to get her to just give me an idea of what she thinks, how she can decipher something with her own reason. But it's strictly, boom, well, just talk to Father. That's what I wanted to add. It was just to more or less go along with this guy was saying as far as their position. It is very, very obvious. I know many people that go to that particular mass for Father Gonzalez. He's not there anymore. It was in Fairfield, New Jersey. But that is more than obvious, the idea that goes on in those chapels. Thank you. That's all I really had
sure.
to say.
Thanks for the call.
Sure.
So basically, he was seeing I don't know if I want to call it a cult mentality, but...
Well, the word came to my mind right away is that word cult, because I would always be told, go to Father on this, go to Father on this. I'd say, why go to Father? And I didn't mean that as, I would say, what authority does Father have? And they said, well, he's a priest. I said, well, John Paul II is a priest. and they're like, yeah, but Father, he's really holy. And that logic is what I would say, if it's not cult, it surely lends to, cult-type behavior.
Yeah, so you could see the lack of sincerity. I mean, it's something where they didn't really sit down and, as you were saying earlier, think deeply about these issues, that these issues really matter. They're really important. This is about the faith. This is about what the church teaches. And that generally the people in the Society Pius X just go to Father, as you were saying, and the priests themselves just don't ever really care to bother to think deeply about these issues.
Yeah, following the priest is foremost, and it, looking at the truth is a low priority.
A thing I want to add is when I would have these, I had numerous discussions with the priest, because I was one of the more, I don't want to say smarter, but willing to do the work of reading out of the people that were there. And so I would be quoting from, I learned from your material. In fact, if you recall, when I first started getting your material, I was challenging you and, challenging you, where do you get that from? What's the book you're using? And you said, the councils. I said, I want to buy a copy. When I bought the copies and I bought Denzinger, and I would bring these, the most authoritative teachings of the church before the priest, the best response I ever got was them scratching their head and kind of shrugging their shoulders and saying, well, I have to be obedient to my bishop, was one response from one of the priests. And I thought, there's a bishop in Rome who you hold to be the bishop of Rome. You can't use, and they're like, I don't know what to say. I was like, there's nothing to be said. It's right here.
Yeah.
And they did. I was struck by their lack of knowledge of the doctrines of the church. I mean, when you really peel the onion a little further there, it's to me it was shocking how little they knew. And because I'm not schooled in this stuff, but I did educate myself. And so when I had to cite the, doctrinal ex-cathedra statements to them that they really were unaware of, and they'd say, where did you get that from? What's that? And I said, it's Denzinger. It's a papal. I'll show you, And not that they were very happy to see me the next time I brought my books with me, but they just didn't know. And one other thing I want to add, that I did have a few notes to myself, mental notes to cover, was the seminarians, the young kids that were going off to seminary. I did start to engage one of them, really getting into where he was willing to read the Council of Trent and a lot of the canons on salvation, on the necessity of the sacraments, and we were making progress. We had some real good, positive exchange for a couple of weeks, and then he went absolutely cold on me. And I called him on it, because he was a really nice guy, and I said, did Father tell you to just stop talking to me? And he kind of just looked away and wouldn't say anything. And I knew that, even the priest, when you start to talk to these, they're like, stay away from that guy. He's dangerous. And to me, that's
Yeah, I actually was just talking to someone from Montana who actually left the Society of Pius V, joined the Society of Pius X, and they're talking to, they hold the position that Benedict XVI is a valid pope, just a bad one, but they're talking about how the society, you have a structure, and it's important to be obedient, and I was pointing out to her, they don't have any obedience to the man that they claim is the head of the Catholic Church, and she's quoting, you can't judge the Holy See, and I'm trying to point out to her that's talking about the popes speaking infallibly in their ordinary universal magisterium or extraordinary magisterium, that's the extraordinary magisterial statements, that's a judgment of the Holy See, and how you're rejecting his canonizations, the authority Vatican II, which was promulgated by a person you believe is a true pope, that you're doing the very thing that you think Sede Vacantists are doing. And it's just really sad. And let's, actually, maybe we can go to another call. Ken from Virginia. Hello?
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I've been listening to your program, and a lot of the things you're saying are very dear to my heart, because I got into the traditional Catholic faith about 4 years ago and started attending a chapel in Northern Virginia. I attended the Indult Mass before that for almost a year. Have gone on several SSPX retreats, and I've picked up the same attitudes that you've been describing. I think there's some variation in the priests' attitudes.
Any specific instances that jump out at you of things that
were strange or...
A lot of things where it seems like there's a yes-no mentality, such as, well, it's okay to come to our chapel and receive the sacraments if you're Sede Vacantist. However, at the same time, we're going to tell your wife that she's in danger of going to hell for being Sede Vacantist. Things like that, which is kind of a yes but no.
Did they ever say that you are a heretic for holding certain positions, or a schismatic for holding the position that Benedict XVI, or maybe it was John Paul II at the time, you were discussing with the priest this issue, that you are a schismatic for holding the position that he's not pope?
I presented it to him that my best guess was the Cardinal Siri thesis was the best thing I've heard of. I was told, well, that's historical, not theological, so you kind of make it, you're within the circle. But what I pick up is more what you're talking about, the attitude and playing games. I've been told many times, go play Parcheesi, stop trying to learn the faith, that's the priest's job. And I don't think that sounds very Catholic. It's more of an attitude thing. I wouldn't call someone a heretic if they said, well, go play Parcheesi instead of trying to learn the faith, but it's more of an attitude of their heart. And I think it's because some of these issues you've been talking about are very unsettling to them. And may, if they embraced them, they may lose money lose parishioners.
I think that actually it's something where, as we show in the new book, The Truth About What Really Happened to the Catholic Church After Vatican II, you can see that Archbishop Lefebvre himself was saying that how can a man who's claiming to be pope be a public heretic and be pope at the same time? And he was saying back in March of 1986 that the upcoming October 27th, 1986, Assisi 1 prayer meeting with different religions, that Archbishop Lefebvre said that we may have to say that this, quote, pope is not pope, because I can't see how a pope can be a public heretic and still be pope at the same time. So it's really ironic that they say, oh, no, it's just such a stupid theory. And we have the Catholic Family News paper saying about Sede Vacantism. What was that quote? Maybe you have that one.
This is a quote that just came out in April. Catholic Family News, it's quoting an article by that was actually put together by the Society of St. Pius X, and they quote Father Garrigou Lagrange, and they say, the eminent Dominican theologian Father Garrigou Lagrange, whose knowledge and erudition surpasses all Sede Vacantists combined, explains in his treatise that a heretical pope, while no longer a member of the church, can still be her head. So first of all, he's advancing the ridiculous position, that actually absurd position, that a heretic can still be the head of the church. And I say it's absurd because Pope Leo XIII in Satis Cognitum said that it's absurd to imagine that he who is outside can command in the church. And that's exactly what Garrigou Lagrange is saying. But what I wanted to point out here is the Catholic Family News actually put this in big letters. They claim that Garrigou Lagrange has knowledge and erudition which surpasses all Sedevacantists combined. So he knows more than all the Sedevacantists combined. I mean, that's one of the most ridiculous statements I've ever read. But that's a statement of a person of bad will. Only a liar would actually print something like that. It's so ridiculously false.
And one of the other things that someone could ask these people that are part of the Society Pius X, just ask them, do you have the same faith as Cardinal Mahony or Benedict XVI? And they say, oh, no, I don't have the same faith. Well, as Pope Pius XII in Mystici Corpus Christi of June 29th, 1943, he says that those who are divided in faith or in government cannot be living in the unity of the same body, the same church. So if you would say that you don't have the same faith as Benedict XVI, John Paul II, Mahony, these other apostates, then you're not in the same church. I don't know what it will take to for these people to realize this point.
And I wanted to make a point to something Patrick said earlier. He was explaining how he was making some progress with his seminarian and how they were really getting into the issues, but then all of a sudden the seminarian went cold on him, and he asked the seminarian if he had spoken to a priest and if the priest had told him to avoid him. And I think in one of our conversations in the past, Patrick had said that that was an example to him of the gospel truth about those who receive the word and they receive it for a short period of time, the parable of the sower, but then they fall away because certain tribulation comes, and most of us wouldn't think of that parable as applying in this context, but I think he's absolutely right, and I just wanted to read that. This is from the Gospel of Matthew chapter 13, speaking of those who receive the word, and our Lord says, "And he that received the seed upon stony ground is he that heareth the word, and immediately receiveth it with joy. Yet he hath not root in himself, but is only for a time. And when there ariseth tribulation and persecution because of the word, he is presently scandalized." So in other words, this guy may have seen the truth of some of the points he was bringing out, may have been interested in it, but because it would have caused him some problems with maybe the priest or someone else, it was easier for him to break off contact. And so I think that definitely fits in to the description here of someone who receives the word with joy or receives the truths of the Catholic faith with joy, but then is scandalized when any tribulation or persecution at all comes.
Yeah. Maybe get a quick call. We have Alexander from Connecticut. Alexander, you on? Hello?
Hello.
Hello? Okay, I guess he's not with us. Maybe you can go back. Must have gotten disconnected. You can go back to the fellow from Virginia. Maybe you could just tell us any other stories, interesting stories you have. You're mentioning some of the...
Another issue I've wondered about is NFP, Natural Family Planning. I think it seems to me that it's wrong, because the intention of avoiding children is there whether there's an activity or not physically. From what I've seen, I can't find any traditional priests who would agree with that. You have all these issues out there like that. I would, like instead of a contest, for example, or baptism of desire, I think it'd be great if SSPX or all the traditionalists would at least have peace with people that are trying to figure out these issues, or hold the minority position, perhaps, and not deny them sacraments.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll address that. Thanks for the call. With regard to NFP, we have the points which cover it on our website, in the article, and it's also in the section in the new book. It's simply put that it's a subordination of the primary purpose of marriage and the Marriage Act to secondary purposes. And so Pope Pius XI makes it clear that no matter what one does, one cannot subordinate the primary purpose of marriage and the Marriage Act to secondary purposes. And there's no doubt about it that NFP does that. It deliberately tries to avoid the primary purpose of marriage for other reasons. So that's the simplest way to demonstrate it from the teaching of Pope Pius XI. And maybe we could go back to Patrick now. And I just wanted to ask you, we had spoken with another gentleman from St. Mary's, Kansas recently, who I asked him, what is the typical reaction of people when you approach them about these issues? Do they talk to you at all, or do they immediately run to the priest? And he said that if they know him pretty well, they might engage him a little bit, but if they don't, they'll probably immediately report him to the priest if he is found to deviate at all from the positions of the Society of St. Pius X. Would you say that your experience was pretty much the same or not quite that radical?
Yeah, I think in the beginning I had a lot more clout, if you will, because, I mean, the families that I was working with saw me working very hard in my, you know, the homeschool education of my children. They entrusted me with their children to, you know, go on, you know, trips to Winona. So I had a lot of goodwill, trust built up with a lot of prominent family members. So I guess they gave me a lot of time, if you will. But when I began to take on the priest, if you will, or to engage in the priest and also to tell others that the priest was teaching heretical positions, a typical Sunday after a mass, I would always have, you know, there are many hellos. It's a very well-knit group, a very conversational group, and all of my hellos just started drying up until I was just, you know, one of those people that would walk over to get my coffee, and I might get a pleasant, how's the weather, you know, while filling up a cup of coffee. But, yeah, it all kind of evaporated when I, you know, I think going against the priest, and also a big one that I didn't mention, well, I kind of touched on it, but with this seminarian, but with the younger children that were looking forward to going to seminary or going to the SSPX monasteries, at one point I just said, you know what, I know the parents are going to hate me, but I really see a young soul here who has a vocation. And so I would just, you know, I had parents telling me, do not talk to my wife. I had a husband say to me, I do not want you to talk to my wife anymore. Or, I do not want you to speak to my child again. So
it's almost a physical threat, wasn't it?
Well, yeah. It wasn't a threat, you know, in legal terms, but it was a very serious, you know, and you could see the emotion behind it, to where I don't want to have, you know, I like I said, I'm trying to stay at the bigger picture. I saw this place as a place where my children could, you know, in a social setting, be around Catholics. That was what's so appealing. Mm. And yet, when I saw ultimately what happened there, if you assimilate into the culture of the group, and your children are playing with their children, you're going over to houses and all that, you know, and you're a social active member, it just can't work together, because your friend who's invited to your house, you're telling his child who's, you know, just entering adulthood, that they've been praying for a vocation and now their son has a vocation, and I'm telling them, don't go to the SSPX, you may lose your faith. They just don't mix. And then it got pretty serious with people giving me very serious and stern stay away from us, you know. And I was like, okay, I'm not gonna force it. I don't want to fight.
It's really a shame that people don't have a community in that kind of setting, you know, to take their children. And
that's fully Catholic.
It's fully Catholic, yeah.
Where, people don't run from the truth.
That, I think, is the starker reality of our times, that what once used to be Catholic, you know, there were Catholic countries, Catholic provinces, Catholic towns and communities, the Catholic life is it's a desert wasteland for you know, someone like me and other families that have children, and they're trying to hack it out in this world. It's a that can be a very troubling spot, along with all the, you know, the heresies that you see. Just teaching morality in a social framework, is there's no social there's a very limited social interaction that's available for the family life or the community life, and yet you're drawn into the SSPX for that very reason. And then this is what lies behind it. I think if you really pursue the purity of the faith, it's a very difficult struggle for, I would think, for so many out there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's one of the major features of the final days, is that, you know, so many people will be drawn into certain heretical positions or positions that God doesn't want them to take, because they're going with what they think provides them a sense of camaraderie or sense of community, and
yeah,
and not necessarily a sense of truth. And so at times, and for many people in certain places, there is a sort of desolation because the faith is not backed up by these support systems where they can go, you know, every week and so forth. And so I think that's definitely a major feature of what we're dealing with here.
And I think for me, at least, the course I've taken in this is a devotion to Our Lady, and really seeking her protection for the souls of my children and my family. And I believe that she has, you know, the ability to supply whatever graces are necessary for the duties of state of these people. So I don't want to, for those like me that are out there, I think there's a great hope in Our Lady and devotion to Our Lady to kind of to cope with this.
Yeah.
I think devotion to the Rosary becomes all the more important.
Yeah, and it's not that the society doesn't do some good things. I mean, we don't want to get that just keep on, you know, pointing out obviously their deficiencies and where they really have serious problems. They do some good things, but you see this general attitude with a lot of people, though, that they get, you know, they just talk to their family members, they're really attached to their family, or they get involved with other friends at a particular church, and they don't really care about, you know, what the church teaches, what does God want me to do. It's sort of like, if that's what most people are doing and believing, if it seems to be traditional, I'm just going to go with that.
And that's one of the reasons why the Society of St. Pius X has been so successful in gaining big numbers of followers. It's not because their doctrinal positions are so sound. It's because they have chapels and they have priests, and most people, you know, that's what they're looking for, the place they can show up on Sunday and go to Mass. And that's about the level they reach as far as delving into the faith and really getting into these issues. And sadly, their devotion to God is not that strong. And it's really primarily a Sunday thing for even many of these people who go to the Society of St. Pius X, and they really have little, and in most cases, if at all, any devotion to God's truth. And that's what we see, unfortunately, as you question more and more of these people about what they believe and what they're willing to accept from the teaching of the church. And it's unfortunate. I think one thing we've discovered is we expected more people to have goodwill, to have response. There certainly are. I mean, definitely activity and people are coming around, but you're astounded by the amount of people who refuse to see the truth.
And you're also astounded by the amount of people that you talk to that go to the Society of Pius X week after week, month after month, year after year, and you tell them, do you realize that the Society of Pius X's official position, while you may not hear it from the pulpit, it's printed right in their books that people in different religions can be saved without the Catholic faith? Oh, no. No, my priest doesn't believe that. I mean, I don't know how many times, it's virtually every single time you talk to someone that goes to the Society of Pius X, and they say, no, you're wrong.
And then when you question them further about, so you don't believe any Buddhists or Jews can be saved, that person winds up saying that he believes that very thing.
Yeah. You have to say, you know, well, we don't know the mercy of God. And I say, well, wait a second. At the beginning of the conversation, you said that, you know, no, that's not true. The Society of Pius X doesn't hold that terrible position that you're trying to say that they hold.
When that
and then you find out that they hold the same position. And they're saying you're not informed as to what the society believes. And yet they're the ones that are going week after week. And in this many cases, year after year. And you can just tell that, you know, that kind of attitude, obviously, and that kind of belief is not going to get it done
and,
when it comes
and
to
it
salvation.
And it applies to the Society of St. Pius V and the CMRI as well. It's
that
just...
brings another point up that I did want to mention, too. The SSPX, at least in as far as I was a part of it, was not really about going out and converting. I think when you are, you then want to defend your doctrines. That becomes very important when you want to convert others.
Yes.
And so... I don't know whether it's chicken or the egg, but there just seems to always be an inflow of people into the doors. But yet, if I go down there, you know, and for 3 months, maybe I'll be going to a different chapel nearby to me, and I go down there, the faces are also always changing, but the pews are always filled. So I think a lot of people come thirsting for doctrine, but don't stay, and they go somewhere else. But they do, the Mass is a real draw.
And
it's just another, I guess, characteristic that I noticed. I can't speak for all their chapels.
I know we know someone from Texas, a former seminarian of the Society of Pius X, and they were actually out on a trip. And he started, this person, Michael from Texas, started to talk to other people. This one particular person was a Protestant. And the Society of Pius X priest came over to Michael and said, "You don't want to talk to that Protestant." And he said, "Why not? I'm trying to tell him about the Catholic faith." And he said, "No, he said, you'll just make him more responsible before the judgment seat of God." I mean, what a lack of charity. I mean, this is horrible.
And I actually got to know another family of the Society of St. Pius X, another family which externally would seem to be very devoted to the Catholic faith, but... like the older son hadn't even informed his good Novus Ordo friends about the obligation to avoid the new Mass, and it was just really pathetic. And you saw in so many of these cases, and he actually expressed sort of shock that someone would have the courage to actually inform his friends of that issue. And so you started to see that because they believe that souls can be saved in non-Catholic religions, they don't have the foundation where they really believe the Church is supernatural and necessary.
And it
carries over into everything.
Yeah, and also because they accept these guys that are doing all these horrible things and promoting all this heresy that are heretics themselves, they accept them as part of the Church too, even though they say, well, we've got some problems. And it's just really a shame. I know also, I know it was the case years ago, it may still be the case, the Society of Pius X also puts out an official booklet of masses where you can go to Mass. All of them are Society Pius X chapels. I mean, or
no
priests that work
masses.
With them. Yeah, no indult masses. No, obviously, like CMRI or independent priests. You have to basically be in tight with the Society Pius X. Otherwise, they say don't even go.
They actually look down upon those who would approach a Byzantine or an indult Mass. And when you really think about that, I mean, that's quite schismatic. Because they're the ones who actually defend that these guys represent the legitimate hierarchy. And so what problem could they have with you going to the approved Latin Mass under the authorities they recognize? And no, they actually discourage it, and you can only go to the ones they recognize. So, I mean, that's quite revealing.
It's just absolutely... amazing, almost. I know there was one priest actually in the Midwest who held some of the Society Pius X's same views on this subject, who was saying that, I think it was Father Bitzer, I think he may still hold the same position today, but he told someone I know that I won't give you communion if you go to the indult Mass. I mean, think about that. I mean, it's something where you're saying that he's a pope, just a bad one. And you're going to say that someone who goes to an indult Mass, the officially approved Mass that they've given for people who are attached to the Latin Mass to go to, and you're saying if someone goes to that and then tries to come to your chapel, you're not going to give them the sacraments?
And I mean, at the same time, they condemn those who would say that these bishops hold no authority. I mean, it's just amazing.
In fact, actually, I think when it comes to the indult Mass, the Society of Pius X, I think they may feel like the indult mass is an evil, you know, mass.
Oh, yeah, they feel it's basically an evil substitute for their set of chapels.
And then you have also the issue of calling the post-Vatican II church, the new religion, these kinds of terms that they're throwing out.
And the deeper we get into this apostasy, the more evil their position becomes. I mean, I think it's definitely proportional that as far as the longer we stay in this and the more heretical the Vatican II sect becomes, the more false documents it issues. And the more they reject and the more they maintain this impossible position, the more pernicious to souls their positions in that regard become, because it's just, it becomes a total rejection of papal infallibility.
And we would say definitely that certainly any priest of the Society of Pius X that feels that if you're a sedevacantist, you're not Catholic, or we don't want you here if you hold that, or if you hold that only baptized Catholics can be saved, we don't want you here, you're not Catholic, or you may be a heretic, or you may be in danger of going to hell, a person definitely should not go to any chapel or priest that feels that way. And obviously, with these guys, they're just, I mean, they would be certainly notoriously heretical. And some of these guys are notoriously schismatic.
And some of them may be private sedevacantists. We actually got a question about that. Maybe we'll read it more on the next program. But a person was asking whether there are sedevacantist priests who are privately sedevacantists in the Society of St. Pius X. And I think it's quite obvious that there are a certain number. But they just sort of go along without voicing any opposition because they feel that providing the sacraments is more important than that issue. And
there are definitely some other priests in their group that feel that, you know, they don't really know the truth on these issues, or they haven't formed a definite conclusion on these topics. Actually, one of the Society of Pius X priests, I was told, actually, even on the baptism issue, just said that, well, look, I haven't looked into this issue, and I don't know one way or another right now. I'm just not a theologian, he was saying, and which was a little bit surprising on that issue. I wouldn't usually accept almost ever that a Society of Pius X priest would even ponder that that you have to be a baptized Catholic to be saved. That correct Catholic position is the one that's right. But apparently in France, someone was saying that a lot of their priests in France actually are privately sedevacantists, that they withhold the name of Benedict XVI out of the canon. And so apparently some of them are privately sedevacantists, and those kinds of priests, you know, maybe they could possibly be an option for receiving the sacrament, certainly not contributing to them.
I think that also kind of proves a point that the nature of their hierarchy is schismatic in its composition, because you don't have the unity which is characteristic of the church. Though you have priests and sacraments, that unity, you can see it lacking in many aspects. I think that's one of them.
Yeah. One thing I was going to ask you about, did you notice a mentality which seemed to promote elevation to the seminary at Winona or a vocation among the Society of St. Pius X as sort of like the end-all, and that those, you know, nothing could be, you know, better than that, and all these issues would take a back seat to, you know, possibly getting my son into Winona as a priest. Would you say that's something you saw, or...?
Yeah, and I think it's like one of those half-true things. I mean, it is a wonderful thing when a young man has a vocation and fulfills it. It's a wonderful and glorious thing, and yet at the same time, I think it's overemphasized. Well, it's emphasized by ignoring the faith issue. But yeah, there's a kind of magic about it that you can't bring up anything that was like I would do.
It's so-called magic, yeah.
Kind of taboo.
Yeah.
So as far as any other, quick as far as, did you ever ask them about the ratifications of the documents of Vatican II?
With my final talk with Father Gonzalez, I did point out to him, and I brought literature. I brought your literature with me on the binding language of the council documents, and he just didn't even. He gave me the impression that he just wasn't interested, kind of keeping his eyes off the paper, and I brought that one up with two of the priests because that was when your issue 4, I think, came out on the. It kind of tackled the argument of the papacy. They seem to go for this pastoral nature argument of the council, and not that, that is a logical argument, but to introduce facts into it is just not a real. They don't understand or show that when the magisterium speaks authoritatively, it has spoken, it's done. They continue with a lot of theoretical arguments.
Did you notice an interest in the writings of Malachi Martin or the positions of Malachi Martin, or is that something you didn't really come across?
He was often talked about. One of the priests would mention him. Some of his writings or comments that they knew he made. I thought they were cooperating with him at one point for candidates for the priesthood. But I just, I really don't know what to make of this Malachi Martin.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, well, yeah, great. We really appreciate you coming on and giving us your experiences with the Society of Pius X. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Patrick.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity, and thanks for, again, all your work. It's helped me and my family.
Okay. Sure, no problem.
Okay.
We wanted to read, actually... some of Archbishop Lefebvre's comments actually on this post-Vatican II church. They're actually in the book on page 485. And maybe after these quotes, we can just briefly have a few quotes on how actually they believe members of non-Catholic religions can be saved right from their own books, because we have people time and again tell us that, that's not what the society holds. That's not what the Society Pius X prints. That's not what they publish. So we need to repeat that again. This is Archbishop Lefebvre, August 4th, 1976. The Council, Vatican II, turned its back on tradition and broke with the Church of the past. It is a schismatic council. If we are certain that the faith taught by the Church for 20 centuries can contain no error, we are much less certain that the Pope is truly Pope. Heresy, schism, excommunication, ipso facto, or invalid election are all causes that can possibly mean that the Pope was never Pope or is no longer Pope. Because ultimately, since the beginning of Paul VI's pontificate, the conscience and faith of all Catholics has been faced with a serious problem. How is it that the Pope, the true successor of Peter, who is assured of the help of the Holy Ghost, can officiate at the destruction of the Church, the most radical, rapid, and widespread in her history? Something that no heretic has ever managed to achieve. And then he goes on, August 29th, 1976, quote, "The new rite of Mass is an illegitimate rite. The sacraments are illegitimate sacraments. The priests who come from these seminaries are illegitimate priests." Lefebvre, September 11th, 1976, quote, "The documents," speaking on the document, Vatican II document on religious liberty, "The document of Vatican II on religious liberty contains passages that are word for word contrary to what was taught by Gregory XVI and Pius IX. Lefebvre, February 22nd, 1979, "Insofar as it is opposed to tradition, we reject the council, Vatican II." Lefebvre, Sermon Easter, 1986, this is the one I think I was talking about earlier, quote, this is the situation in which we find ourselves. I have not created it. I would die to make it go away. We are faced with a serious dilemma which I believe has never existed in the Church. The one seated on the chair of Peter takes part in the worship of false gods. What conclusions will we have to draw, perhaps in a few months' time, faced with these repeated acts of partaking in the worship of false religions? I don't know, but I do wonder. It is possible that we might be forced to believe that the Pope is not the Pope, because it seems to me initially, I do not yet want to say it solemnly and publicly, that it is impossible for a Pope to be publicly and formally heretical. Then we have Lefebvre's sermon, August 27th, 1986, quote, "He who now sits upon the throne of Peter mocks publicly the first commandment of the Creed and the first commandment of the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments. The scandal given to Catholics cannot be measured. The Church is shaken to its very foundations." Lefebvre, October 28, 1986, quote, "John Paul II has encouraged false religions to pray to their false gods. It is an unprecedented and intolerable humiliation to those who remain Catholic." Lefebvre, July 14, 1987, quote, "If there is a schism, it is because of what the Vatican did at Assisi. Being excommunicated by a liberal, ecumenical, and revolutionary church is a matter of indifference to us." Lefebvre, July 14, 1987, again, quote, "Rome has lost the faith. Rome is in apostasy." Lefebvre, August 29, 1987, quote, "The See of Peter and the posts of authorities in Rome are occupied by Antichrist. The destruction of the kingdom of our Lord is being rapidly carried out. This is what has brought down upon our heads persecution by the Rome of the Antichrist." Here he is. This is actually the declaration given to the press before the June 30th, 1988 Episcopal consecrations. Quote, "The Church holds all communion with false religions and heresy in horror. To safeguard the Catholic priesthood, which perpetuates the Church and not an adulterous Church, there must be Catholic bishops." And then he goes, speaking of the leaders of the Vatican II sect, quote, "We cannot work together with these enemies of our Lord's reign." And then, again, speaking of the leaders of the Vatican II sect, quote, "We cannot follow these people. They're in apostasy. They do not believe in the divinity of our Lord Jesus Christ, who must reign. What is the use in waiting? Let us do the consecration." So this is actually, you know, Lefebvre, I don't know how many people that go to the Society Pius X have even actually heard these quotes, because it's obvious.
Yeah, I mean, to this day, they publish books which condemn sedevacantism and sedevacantists, and they don't tolerate the view in many cases. They're very opposed to it, except for, you know, that handful or small number of priests who privately hold it. But their official position is very much against it, even though Lefebvre is clearly was on the verge of it and advancing the arguments which make it clear that it's not only possible, but the only logical position to take. But their most obvious heresy, which we've covered and mentioned many times, it's covered in our books, is that they believe that souls can be saved in other religions, and we see how that plays itself out in people and how they don't really want to convert people. They don't really do much to convert people, how the faith is not at the top of the list of priorities. These other considerations are more important, such as community and family and so forth. And it's because they lack the foundational belief in the necessity of the Church and the necessity of Christ. As that young person he dealt with said, you know, we believe Jews can be saved. And so Lefebvre taught in his books, Against the Heresies, page 216, souls can be saved in a religion other than the Catholic religion, Protestantism, Islam, Buddhism, etc. That means in many other religions. So they believe that souls can be saved in any religion, that it's possible. This is also the belief of the CMRI and the Society of St. Pius V, despite what so many of their supporters will try to say. And this is so accepted in the Society of St. Pius X that you can even get their time bombs of the Second Vatican Council, which is a little booklet they put out few years back, and they decided to, it's mentioned in there. Father Schmidberger said, "Ladies and gentlemen, it is clear that the followers of other religions can be saved under certain conditions. That is to say, if they are invincible error."
That's what, on like page 2?
Page 10.
Or 10? Okay, it's right in the book.
So, I mean, it's so widely accepted among the Society of St. Pius X supporters that they have no problem just printing in these little booklets, and it's also in Open Letter to Confuse Catholics, where Lefebvre says the same thing. Bishop Fillet, proving that he also believes this, mentioned that Hindus can be saved in his conference in Denver on February 18, 2006, which was published in the April 2006 issue of the Angelus.
Yeah, maybe you could read this one, because And actually, before you read that, actually, maybe you know, we'll come back to that and take a call from Jim in Wisconsin. Hello, Jim. Hello. Jim.
Hello there. Yeah.
Hi.
Hi.
You had a question
or a comment?
Yes. I was listening to the program, and you were commenting on the Society of St. Pius X and the instances of the chapels. And I guess my comment to add in was that in our area here in Wisconsin is that some of the chapels are a little more kind than others. And I think a lot of it has to do with the priest itself. And a couple areas where they're strong, with the retreats and against the Americanism, and that's a couple of their stronger suits. But in a lot of the other instances that you brought up this evening, it's very true. And you see it, I think, especially where there's the schools, because it brings the families in, and then the social settings start to kick in. And so on a lot of those points, I have to say, I agree. I see that happening a lot.
Yeah, it's really sad. It's really actually sad. And I'm kidding, because we certainly don't, you know, enjoy just, you know, attacking, you know, different groups for the sake of attacking someone. But this has to be, you know, stated. And, you know, the faith matters. And according to the society or some of the people that go there sometimes, they think the Mass is actually, you know, above the faith. And it's not. That's why the Athanasian Creed says whoever wishes to be saved needs above, before all else, to hold the Catholic faith.
And I think what his point is very true, that since the Society of St. Pius is such a large group of priests and people, that you would expect a difference among, you know, the people and the priests, that some would be more conservative than others, and some would be more receptive to the truth than others, and some would be more heretical than others, such as Father Francois Lanné, who wrote the book Is Fenianism Catholic, which is critiqued in detail in the book on salvation, which we sell, which contains some of the most ridiculous statements and biggest heresies. And he's probably, you know, one of the most evil people in the society, but there are other priests who are a lot more reasonable.
And maybe some of which that you can bring around and be converted. There are people that actually have either independent chapels or places where they want to bring a priest in, and they have to break away from the Society Pius X. And so hopefully if people can, you know, give them the right information, give them, you know, this book, the book Outside the Catholic Church, There is Absolutely No Salvation, give them this new book, The Truth About What Really Happened to the Catholic Church After Vatican II. And if they're sincere and they take a look at it, I mean, there's no denying the arguments. But maybe you can read this quote by Bishop Fillet. This is the current head of the Society Pius X. I mean, this is really amazing, actually, when you think about it. But maybe you can read this one. This isn't, again, the
conference in Denver, February 18th, 2006, published in The Angelus, A Talk Heard Round the World, April 2006, page 5. And the Church has always taught that you have people who will be in heaven, who are in the state of grace, who have been saved without knowing the Catholic Church. We know this. We know this, he says. And yet, how is it possible if you cannot be saved outside the Church? It is absolutely true that they will be saved through the Catholic Church, because they will be united to Christ, to the mystical body of Christ, which is the Catholic Church. It will, however, remain invisible, because this visible link is impossible for them. Consider a Hindu in Tibet who has no knowledge of the Catholic Church. He lives according to his conscience and to the laws which God has put into his heart. He can be in the state of grace, and if he dies in this state of grace, he will go to heaven. That's as heretical as it gets. I mean, that's a bold denial of the dogma outside the Church, there's no salvation. A Hindu is a pagan, so he's contradicting Eugene IV, who defines that all pagans are lost. And he also promotes the invisible church heresy, which is condemned by Pope Leo XIII and Satis Cognitum, Pius XI and Mortalium Animos, Pius XII and Mystici Corporis.
And I think actually at that, when he gave that talk, the so-called Benedictine monks from New Mexico were actually like assisting him at the Mass. I could be wrong about that, but they were there. And some people ask us, you know, well, what about these guys in New Mexico? They seem, you know, very contemplative. And well, I mean, it's just something where here they're hearing the head of their group saying that Buddhists can be saved, a Hindu can be saved, And that's no problem, I guess, for them.
Well, I think we covered on a past radio program that the head of that monastery, Father Cyprian, actually sent out a newsletter in which he described Archbishop Lefebvre as, quote, our infallible guide.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that really is...
I mean, you couldn't even say that about a pope.
Yeah.
As far as outside of his, you know, official infallible teachings.
Yeah, so but they're saying that Lefebvre was an infallible guide. It's just incredible. And so the point is that there are serious doctrinal problems with the Society of St. Pius X. And as people start to encounter others at these chapels, they start to realize that unfortunately many of these people who look externally as if they're dedicated to the true faith are not. It's sincere about it. They're not people of the truth.
Maybe you could also quickly just quote a few of those things that, like Father Linné, and just briefly just give an idea of what's in their books. These are books that actually, I mean, are right in many of the bookstores of the Society of Pius X. The Society encourages people to get these books. They've encouraged people to get the book Is Fenianism Catholic when that came out. And there are just some amazing... lies.
Yeah. On page 47, he says that the Council of his book is Fenianism Catholic. He says that the Council of Florence mentions baptism of desire. It's just a complete lie. It's completely untrue. And I go into detail explaining why he would make this ridiculous statement and how he would attempt to justify it, but it's just a bold lie. In order to really understand how bad it is, you'd have to read our book and see more of what the testimony of tradition on the whole issue of baptism is and what the Church actually teaches on that issue to see how they distort it and they brainwash people with these distortions. Both books, Baptism of Desire, the orange one by Father Rouleau, and Is Fenianism Catholic by Father Linné, say that the fathers of the Church are unanimous in favor of Baptism of Desire. Just a complete lie. Almost all the fathers rejected the idea that a catechumen could be saved by his desire for baptism. It's just a complete perversion of tradition, but of course you can see if these Society of St. Pius X lay people simply follow their priest and aren't obviously inclined to hear what so-called outsiders are going to say, they're going to imbibe this and accept this, and so you see you have an army of people with a distorted view of salvation, a totally perverse view of what tradition actually teaches, and they spread it, and it comes to die. And you even see this in the Society of St. Pius V and the CMRI. They spread these same kind of lies. He goes on, you know, in various areas. We have in Father Jean-Marc Rouleau's book, Baptism of Desire, how he starts out at the beginning of the book explaining how it's necessary to accept the authority of St. Thomas Aquinas, who embraced Baptism of Desire. But later in the book, when he's discussing St. Thomas Aquinas' position that it's necessary to believe explicitly in Jesus Christ and the Trinity, and therefore that those who die ignorant of Jesus Christ and the Trinity, such as the pagan on the island or the pagan in the woods, who's supposedly never heard of the Church, St. Thomas's conclusion is he couldn't be saved. Father Rouleau says, well, we're not sure what authority St. Thomas holds in that matter. The theologians have not been unanimous. But he said at the beginning of the book, to refuse St. Thomas Aquinas is to refuse the magisterium of the Church. So you see blatant hypocrisy, blatant contradictions. And, I mean, there's so many things in these books. I mean,
yeah, and you would think that if they say, well, we have to believe in baptism of desire and blood, and the saints believe that, you would at least think that maybe they would hold that you would have to be a catechumen to be saved, that you would have to actually desire to receive the sacrament of baptism. But no. You know, the Society doesn't believe that, Society Pius V, CMRI, they all don't believe that you have to have the desire to receive the sacrament. So they don't even hold what certain of these saints and other people that speculated on this issue actually believe was the only exception to actually receiving baptism. They've extended this to people in other religions, people have never heard of the gospel, on and on and on. So I would also... we would encourage people to get the audio tape, Outside the Catholic Church, There is Absolutely No Salvation. It's about a two-hour discussion about these issues, and it gets in more in depth on the actual books of the Society of Pius X, so that people can actually look at the books of the Society of Pius X, they can get the page numbers, they can see these quotes themselves, and just look at this information, because people really need to see this, because this really matters. These issues really matter. So,
do you think I should read the language again of the canonization quote?
Yeah, actually, there's this, and yeah, maybe you could do that, because that could be the last point we make here, because this is just really something. You have Father Peter Scott's quote on the Escriva canonization. I don't know if you have that in front of you, but
yeah,
it's just really amazing.
Father Peter Scott, when John Paul II, quote, canonized Jose Maria Escriva, he wrote in November of 2002 that this was, quote, a typical example. And he said, it was the shameful and highly questionable canonization of Monsignor Jose Maria Escriva de Balaguer last October 6th. So he calls the, quote, canonization by John Paul II, the one he thinks is a pope, shameful and highly questionable. He goes on to quote someone else who said, it, the canonization, will offend God. It will stain the church forever. It will take away from the saints their special holiness. It will call into question the credibility of all the canonizations made during your papacy. We cannot possibly consider this canonization as a valid, infallible pronouncement, says Peter Scott. And if we read the language that John Paul II used, it's so solemn.
It's essentially the exact same solemn formula that was used prior to Vatican II by true
popes.
Yeah.
So if you can reject this, then you can reject any of the pre-Vatican II saints. He says, quote, John Paul II, when he, quote, canonized Escriva, and when he, quote, canonizes others, or when Benedict XVI does it now, with the authority of our Lord Jesus Christ, of the blessed apostles Peter and Paul, and our own, after lengthy reflection, having assiduously invoked God's assistance and taken into account the opinion of many brothers of ours in the episcopate, we declare and define blessed Jose Maria Escriva to be a saint, and we enroll him in the catalog of the saints, and we establish that in the whole church he should be devoutly honored among the saints. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. So it doesn't get any more solemn than that. That's language which absolutely parallels and reaches the level of the most solemn statements in
And you have history. Someone like Bishop Williamson, who actually, when this issue came up, he said, are canonizations historically viewed as being infallible? He goes, yes, it's also mentioned in the Catholic Encyclopedia, canonizations are infallible, on and on and on. So, but something must have happened with these ones where we feel that the person's not worthy of canonization, so we're not going to accept that one.
And this is rampant. This is not just the Society of St. Pius X. It's, you know, so many other independent priests and groups who adhere to similar positions, who hold this schismatic position. And this is a prime example of the evil that's coming out of this false resistance position, this false position which continues to accept these guys as popes. And it just leads to these schismatic conclusions.
Yeah. Yeah, and there are actually a few more quotes just briefly, on that following page. We have one actually where one of the bishops actually recently is saying that of the Society of Pius X, that John Paul II, Benedict XVI actually says he published a book full of heresies. And he says it's a book full of heresies, especially against the dogma of the redemption. I mean, he's admitting that these guys are publishing books of heresies.
Bishop Tissier de Maille.
Yeah. It's really something. So you see this all over the place. Actually, most asked questions about the Society of Pius X, question 7. It's talking about, speaking infallibly. To what extent can such minds, speaking of the hierarchy of the Novus Ordo Church, want to irreformably to define or absolutely to impose? They do not, and in fact they cannot.
In other words, these Vatican II antipopes, according to the Society of St. Pius X, cannot speak infallibly.
Yeah.
That's heresy.
Yeah. So there it is. Again.
So we wanted to give some insight as to what people who had come to the conclusion that a Catholic should come to about these issues encountered when he started to share this truth with others, and the resistance that he encountered and some of the experiences he had. So sure. Hopefully people benefited from it.
Okay, good. Well, we'll see you again next week. Thanks.